The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. 4 minutes past nine, Tuesday, the 28th of February, 2023. And you welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show. I do hope you're very well indeed. Thanks to Donald, sat in for me yesterday. So didn't get to see how your weekend was. Let us know. 086 60 25,000. The lines are open for you to get involved in the conversation. We've got plenty lined up for you. But if you want to raise your own issues or pass on some information, use those numbers. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts. If you want to give us a call, the telephone line 07491 25,000. And as we know, lots of you listening from outside the Republic, we want you involved in the conversation as well. 00353, drop the O and the rest of the number, you know yourself. Emails come in to us at comments@highlandradio.com. And of course, you can watch this show as you can every single day of the week live on your smart TV, your Fire Stick. Just go to the YouTube app, the Facebook app, and type in Highland Radio there, or the same apps on your mobile devices, or even on our website, highlandradio.com. Click watch live and have your say there as well. Good to have you on board, as I say. Lots to talk about, so let's crack on with a look at the papers. Drumbo executions to be commemorated three times. That's the front of the Donegal Democrat. Three commemorative events to mark the 100th anniversary of the execution of four anti-treaty Republicans at Drumbo Stranorlar will be held over the next two weekends, and it's causing a bit of confusion. Donegal County Council is organising a low-key affair next Sunday, March 5th, near the site, while Sinn Féin's Drumbo Commemoration Committee has organised a spring school a week later on Saturday week, March 11th, as well as an intimate, smaller commemorative event at the site on the actual anniversary of the execution, March 14th. On to the Derry Journal. Protocol deal turning point. A new deal suspending the Northern Ireland Protocol will eliminate red tape on goods between Britain and the North and remove any sense of a border in the Irish Sea. That's according to Rishi Sunak, who said the Windsor framework announced yesterday marked a turning point. The British Prime Minister said today's agreement delivers the smooth flow of trade within the UK. Goods destined for Northern Ireland will travel through a new green lane with a separate red lane for goods at risk of moving on to the EU. And he goes on to explain it further on the front of the paper. Let's take the national view here, the Irish Independent, on this story. The newly agreed deal between the EU and the UK on the controversial Northern Ireland Protocol has started a waiting game to see how the DUP will respond and whether power sharing can be restored in the North. Already, though, two DUP MPs, most notably perhaps Ian Paisley Jr., has come out and said that this doesn't go far enough. But anyway, the leadership of the party have yet to put their cards on the table. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar joined UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak on hailing the Windsor Framework Agreement as a turning point for Northern Ireland. However, DUP leader Geoffrey Donaldson said his party will not be rushed or pushed into a hasty decision as it takes legal advice on the deal's texts. He acknowledged progress has been made, but added there are still issues of concern. While Mr. Sunak will now attempt to face down Brexiteers within his own Conservative Party in Westminster and convince the DUP to back the new framework, the DUP is unlikely to agree to an early lifting of its boycott of power sharing at Stormont. And with the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement rapidly approaching, there are fears the political instability in the North will continue, and maybe the DUP, with talk of a Biden visit and what have you, feel they are being pushed into something without being able to give it full consideration. Though listening to Simon Coveney this morning, he said the DUP need to be given time to decide then and state their position. On the face of it, it seems like a good deal for Northern Ireland. Their exports are already through the roof by some reports. They'll have full access to Britain, of course, full access to the EU. Sounds like a win-win, but of course there are specific concerns that some have, and those are the concerns that might delay progress. Okay, the Irish Times this morning. The government intends to establish an inquiry into the state's handling of the COVID-19 crisis by the middle of the year. Senior government sources said that key decisions about the format of the inquiry, including whether it would hold sessions in public, had not yet been made. However, consideration is being given currently to who would chair the inquiry and what its terms of reference would be. I imagine really the way that would have to work is that someone would have to come in from outside the country, wouldn't it? Also, the government's framing it as a review. The paper is stating it as an inquiry. Reading on here, there are concerns at senior levels that a public-facing element could invite huge media attention. which could interfere with the functioning of the inquiry or lead those involved in the response to lawyer up. However, there's still a preference for some form of public-facing element. Government sources said the inquiry would not be designed to find fault with or praise individuals or bodies, but focus on the establishing of facts to inform future responses to public health emergencies. So, as I say, the government's framing this as not as an inquiry as to, you know, what went wrong and whose head should roll. They're effectively saying we did what we did at that time, and we need to see what worked, what didn't work, in case there's a future pandemic, which will not go far enough for some, no doubt. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar set the Dáil this month in it that the inquiry was being scoped out, and he said we hope to have it established by the Oireachtas mid-year. However, he said he cannot possibly put a time on how long it will run for. The government has yet to publish a report drawn up by a group headed by Hugh Brady, president of Imperial College London. The report of the Public Health Reform Expert Advisory Group was submitted to the Department of Health in September. And I think some of the key concerns are, and, you know, we asked the same questions. I remember asking questions of the Health Minister on this programme as to the logic of some of what they were introducing. A, the obvious one, cancelling all, well, not cancelling, well, maybe it was cancelling all other types of medical health care, mental health care, respite care, all of that went by the wayside. You know, why? Who made that decision, and what kind of, you know, consideration was given to that? Education, as I say, taking children out of school, what was the logic of that? And of course, then this is the more obvious ones that people had issues with. How people were moved from hospitals into nursing homes right at the very start. Again, something on this programme that we questioned very strongly at the time didn't make a great deal of sense, and on it goes. But anyway, they say it's reviewing what worked, what didn't work, rather than sort of going down a blame game route. Good to see the Education Minister has done a U-turn, rolled back, however you want to phrase it, on changes to the Leaving Cert. Everyone concedes, I think, that change is required, but the proposals that were made didn't make any sense, put students under a great deal of pressure. I think kind of maybe would have interfered with transition year for some, which I think is a really important year. Not everyone agrees, but I that's what I feel. And this, well, I'll read on and we'll get to the crux of the story. Norma Foley has lost a battle with teachers' unions over the proposed reform to the Leaving Cert cycle, with plans to have the first paper for both English and Irish papers at the end of fifth year now paused. Last March, the Education Minister announced a raft of changes and reforms to the Leaving Cert cycle. Chief amongst them were plans for students to sit the first paper of both the English and Irish subjects at the end of fifth year. Now, there were a think tank or a group of individuals, or however you might want to describe it, made a series of proposals. That was not amongst them. And I think the consensus is, it seems, that, you know, for these exams, firstly, there has to be a level of maturity, doesn't there, in terms of writing, okay? Also, if you were doing transition year or not, you could be advantaged or disadvantaged. There is the general sense that boys develop later than girls, so they would be disadvantaged, and also that it requires a two-year cycle for these two exams, and only one would have been afforded. So good to see, I think, that this decision has been reversed. The move, though, was opposed by teachers' unions, organisations representing English language teachers and Irish language organisations. The plans were due to come into place for those students entering the Leaving Cert cycle this September. However, Ms. Foley will now bring proposals to Cabinet to defer those plans following objections from a range of stakeholders, which is effectively a different way of saying she's scrapped the plans. That's not returning, unless there's more reform elsewhere. Right, if you were reading the papers yesterday, listening to the news, listening to this programme, I'm sure you would have heard what seemed like good news for some. Electricity prices for businesses coming down 10%, gas prices coming down 15%, but why not us? What about the hard-pressed regular folk out there paying through the nose for power? Well, Electric Ireland has been accused of shafting ordinary domestic customers in favour of business customers after the announced tariff reductions for commercial accounts only. Now, before I read on personally, for me, I don't know the tone of this article in the Irish Daily Star, but businesses need, obviously, to be paying less for their electricity and their gas. So I welcome them extending these cuts to those areas. But as I say, questions need to be asked as to why you can cut it for a certain group of customers and not others. Labour's finance spokesperson and TD for Louth, Jed Nash, said the news would stick in the craw for ordinary households struggling to pay the bills. The energy firms will be reducing, the energy firm will be reducing electricity prices by 10% for small and medium enterprises and gas prices by 15%. The bigger players already have deals with a lot of the electricity suppliers, by the way. That's why they're excluded. Mr. Nash said the Electric Ireland buys energy for the same price, so he wants an explanation why there are two different pricing structures. He told the Star, we know that Electric Ireland has given a €50 credit to customers, and this is welcome, but this decision will really stick in the craw of hard-pressed domestic bill payers. And you have even leading members of government who perhaps should be... Like, I was listening to Simon Coveney this morning. Saying, you know, we need an explanation as to why once energy prices go up, on the wholesale prices go up, very quickly bills go up. But then when on the wholesale markets, when electricity and gas prices come down, the companies are very slow to bring those prices down. Now, I welcome the fact that Simon Coveney, and I've nothing against him, by the way, of course, I'm glad that he recognises that that's an issue, because that's what we're all saying. But for an incredibly senior member of government, probably in the top five members of this current government, I just found it strange him posing that question rather than suggesting an answer or a solution. Do you know, like, we don't elect politicians to sort of parrot what we're saying. You know, it's great that they get it, but I would have thought that he and his team and the rest of government would be working tirelessly in the background and know the answer to those questions. And if they don't like the answers, you know, to hold those that make those decisions to account. But he's just with us asking the same question. And that, to me, I would just like to see, I would just like to see maybe answers rather than questions. The Sun this morning. Councils have seen a surge in requests to turn old pubs into homes. Some 260 applications to turn commercial premises into housing were filed last year, with 53 of those for ex-boozers. It comes after Housing Minister Dara O'Brien waived the need to apply for planning permission to make them a gaff. He said these figures show that government regulations to allow former vacant pubs be converted into homes without needing planning permission is helping to tackle the problem of vacancy. Well, listen, let's not run away with ourselves. But anyway, I suppose if you're looking to do that and you have to face less red tape, all the better. Now, keep an eye out for this, mums and dads and caregivers, because three children who ate cannabis-infused jellies, which are up to 10 times stronger than inhaling the drug, thought they were normal sweets. And there's absolutely no reason why they wouldn't think they are normal sweets. They're packaged like sweets. They look like sweets. They probably smell like sweets. But anyway, keep an eye out for these. The youngsters described by Gardaí as preteens came across the product, which is marketed as Bunts on Sunday. So we'll all have to keep an eye out for that. Right, we're going on to the telephone lines now to DUP MP Gregory Campbell. Good morning, Gregory. Thanks for taking the call today. I understand you've been very busy with press inquiries, so we welcome your time. Right, OK. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and President of the European Commission Ursula von der Leyen have announced this new deal aimed at fixing post-Brexit problems in Northern Ireland. So on the face of it, I think we can agree, is there, that progress has been made. But from your perspective, Gregory, do you think enough progress has been made?
Well, I think the first part of what you said there is right. There's no doubt progress has been made, and nobody should be churlish and say it hasn't. It's just inconceivable that anyone could say no progress has been made. What was a bit annoying yesterday, more than a bit annoying, was for me to sit in the chamber in Westminster and listen to dozens of MPs and the Prime Minister reply to their queries. And, you know, you would have thought the protocol, which they were all lauding and they all voted for, you would have thought suddenly it had sprouted two horns and a tail, because it was terrible. It was diverting trade. It was doing all the things that we said it would do at the time. And now they had to have this new deal because of the awfulness of the old one that they had voted on. So set that to one side. Progress has been made, particularly on the trading front. That is good, and we should bank that. There are other problems in terms of the constitutional political issues. So let's see if we can resolve them and move on.
We are hearing from your colleagues, the likes of Ian Paisley, giving a very cool response to this very early on. Are you holding back till you get into the a little deeper into the legal text of this before you sort of let us know what you're thinking in terms of whether this will get power sharing back up and running again?
Yes, and I think any sensible person should do that. You know, you don't accept something at face value. You look at it, you examine it, you try to establish what the legal text puts into statute and then what it will mean in practice. So those are things that we have to do now. We will take our time to do it. There's no point in rushing it. You know, his name's Rishi, not Rushy. So let's not rush this deal. Let's get it right. It's not right at the minute, so let's pause, examine it closely, look at the detail and see where progress can be made on it.
So from your perspective, do you see this as a starting point? In other words, do you imagine that your party might go back to the likes of Rishi Sunak and say, OK, you've made some progress here, but we also need this?
Well, we'll put it like this. 2 years ago, the protocol was implemented and we said, look, there are going to be serious problems with this. Initially, the government demurred from that and said, no, this is the best deal that can be got. Thankfully, they've now moved. The reason there has been movement on the EU side, as well as on our own government side, is because of two principal things. One was the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill that they tabled in Westminster, which put severe pressure on the EU to move. And the other was the unified position of the unionist community towards the old protocol. Now, in our opinion, the government has made a mistake. Rishi Sunak has made a big mistake in taking the protocol bill off the table because that releases the pressure from the EU. But the one thing he will not do is remove the other bit of pressure, which is the unified approach of the unionist people. We have got to get a deal that suits unionism and suits nationalism. This is not about excluding anyone.
And all the rest of the people, all the rest of the people that live in Northern Ireland as well, the two groups you talk of. Do you believe this removes the west-east, east-west border on your initial reading of it?
It improves it. It improves it significantly. But remember, and I don't want to appear churlish, but remember, it takes us some way back to where we should have been 2 years ago. You know, the Prime Minister trumpets the removal of blocking, for example, any reduction in VAT. So, for example, about 18 months ago, in the middle of the cost of living crisis, he, as Chancellor, was going to introduce a reduction of VAT on home heating oil, which would have been a very welcome move. But he couldn't do it because of the EU regulations as contained in the protocol. We pointed that out. He's now saying that now means that they can do that. But he always should have been able to do it. You know, so you don't trumpet something. It's like someone, it's like a wife beater being praised for stop beating his wife. You know, if there were a whole series of problems and now some of them have been removed, that's good. But we never should have had the problems in the first place. We've got them removed. That's good. We bank that. Now let's complete the deal. Mm. Let's get it done right. Not rushed. Get it right.
Do you think the sticking point might end up being down to the Stormont break and how effective that actually is in terms
that
of...
Will be that will be an important part of it. Let's examine that, see what that means, see how it would work in practice. And, you know, as I say, let's get a deal that everyone can live with. There will be some people who will not approve of anything that's on the table. There will be other people who would approve everything, no matter what was on the table. We don't fall into either of those two camps. If the meal's good, we'll eat of it. If it's not, we'll decline.
And do you feel that the DUP might come under further pressure? Probably it won't allow itself to be, but you get the sense that the bunting is going up and the red carpet's already being rolled out for the likes of a President Biden visit with that very important day on the horizon.
Well, I've heard two surnames beginning with B lauding the deal, and that was Joe Biden and Steve Baker. Long after Steve Baker and Joe Biden have departed the political scene, both in America and in GB, we, the people of Northern Ireland, will have to live with this agreement as it is either presented or changed or modified. So let's forget about Steve Baker and Joe Biden. Let's get this right for this generation and future generations.
And very finally, what is the situation?
Because I'm going to have to go.
Well, do you know what? It's not an important question, so I shall let you go, Gregory. I do appreciate your time, okay? I'll let you go. Thank you very much indeed for that. All right, take care. As I say, there's no point delaying him for a question that's not terribly important. Senator Niall Blaney's with us as well. He is spokesperson on Northern Ireland and a member of the Good Friday Agreement Committee. Your reaction to this deal, Niall?
Yeah, I think it's great to be here after so many years, Greg. There was many points where I thought we'd never get this far. That said, you have to listen to people like Gregory Campbell that still aren't still don't have confidence in the deal. And I suppose that's why Richie Sunak is coming to government today to tease out those issues that still exist. But we're a long way down the road. To I think maybe satisfying most or all those around the table, and I do hope that the concerns raised are hammered out, and the small solutions that are outstanding can be resolved.
It's interesting to listen to Gregory Campbell there, and I put it to him, you know, that some the likes of Ian Paisley Jr. had already kind of said on first reading, and not quite literally saying that, but that this doesn't go far enough. And he said that, and I don't want to misquote him, that it would be foolish to jump to that level of confusion. I'm not implying or suggesting there's any splits within the DUP, but there does seem to be really quite some senior figures within that party that aren't precisely on the same page.
Yeah, I've no doubt that Jeffrey Donaldson's under pressure from within his own party circles, and that's political parties. That's the way it goes, the different views across the board. But in the round, you know, there has been a reasonable welcome from the DUP, and they have asked for that space to hammer out the detail. And I think today, the opportunity what's looking like is a perfect opportunity, and hopefully they can put any outstanding issues to bed.
Yeah, this is very much, though, being launched and announced, and even, you know, the helicopters up in the sky tracking cars moving around London and the language that's being used. This has been very much framed to me as, well, this is the deal. This is, we have it. This is what fixes everything. I'm not sure if they see it as, I mean, obviously it is incredibly significant, but is that, do you think, in some way to put pressure on those who might have issues with it to seem to appear to be stubborn or outliner? Because this was not launched yesterday as a starting point, Senator. This, the way I saw it, was the final solution.
You're seeing people at the helm here who have been at the height of negotiations the last number of weeks, that have sat down with all parties, realised the difficulties, and their firm belief is that all those issues that are raised with them are actually addressed in the document. Now, albeit that the likes of the DUP maybe aren't as au fait with the document as Rishi Sunak or Ms. van der Leyen. But they're, you know, at the end of the day, if you're selling a deal like this, you have to sell it with confidence. And no doubt when they go to Stormont today, they'll sell it with confidence. But they also have to take on board any outstanding issues. And if these issues are new, that's one thing. But if there were issues that were flagged already, and you mentioned there in relation to the break, already there seems to be issues arising out of the break, the understanding of how that will operate. I suppose there was a similar model used in relation to the new deck and new approach in 2020, in relation to getting the Stormont up and running. It had a mechanism whereby there would have to be an agreement on all sides, or on both sides of the divide.
But the problem I think we're going to have here, though, Niall, is that at what point can we, the general public, make a call as to whether the DUP will or will not back this deal, let's just say not back this deal because they don't like the deal, or they will blame the deal because they don't like playing second fiddle to Sinn Féin? I mean, there's going to come a point, and I don't know when that might be, where we're going to have to, you know, separate the wood from the trees.
That may be the case, Gray, but anything in relation to Northern Ireland is never easy. And for me, the important thing is to keep talking and keep finding solutions. Sometimes deadlines are useful, other times they're not. I think the majority of the work is done here. A lot of us outstanding could be misunderstanding, but there's further engagement to go here. A few more days is now here to there for me. There will come a point, you're right, though, there will come a point where the DUP will have to say, you know, we're with this or not. But there's a reality too. They've done an awful lot of playing here, and having the protocol renegotiated, there's an awful lot of wins in this for them. It'd have been an awful shame for them to throw that away and not agree with it at this stage. I think those outstanding issues can be resolved. Like the protocol, the vast majority of the issues in the protocol have been resolved. And I think those outstanding issues can be resolved as well. Sometimes you have to just bite your tongue and roll with it and keep negotiating and find solutions.
Okay, listen, thanks for your time this morning and your initial reaction to that. That's Senator Niall Blaney there. 086 60 25,000, what's your views? Give us a call on 0749 125,000, particularly if you're listening to us in most likely Derry and Tyrone. Maybe you're a business person and you, or not. Any person, it doesn't matter. We want you involved in the conversation as well, by the way. Lots of you listening to us in that area, very valued listeners as well. So call us 00353 749 125,000, 00353 749 125,000, or to WhatsApp and text 00353 86 60 25,000. Right, okay. Tom Murray, spokesperson for Border Communities Against Brexit. He's with us now. Tom, how are you getting on? Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for your time. Okay, the group you represent, I presume, is welcoming this, because it seems like a win-win for us and border counties in terms of, you know, our movement, but for businesses too in the north, and obviously us as well.
Yeah, we welcome it. I think if we go back to when Brexit first happened and we were formed the day after the first Brexit vote in Britain, our only concern was that there would be no negative impact on the Good Friday Agreement, the peace process, or any element of a border back on the island of Ireland. So we're satisfied that we're still in that situation, and permanently there's a resolution which removes the risk of a border on the island of Ireland. That was always being threatened. It was always being questioned about when changes may be made to how checks are being made, or EU regulation between differences between the north and the south. That matter has been resolved. Everybody in all parties has accepted there will be no border on the island of Ireland. I think what's great about this is it allows us to carry on in life the way we've done for the last 25 years. We're about to celebrate 25 years of the Good Friday Agreement. We've seen massive improvements in the economy and the social infrastructure and the connectivity across the island, the all-island economy, shared healthcare initiatives, and just the ease at which 40 million vehicles cross the border on an annual basis, whether that's children going to school, families meeting up, going to GAA games, or day-to-day business being run. That is guaranteed to continue without any interruption, without any checks, without any stops. And I think that's fundamentally the most important thing for us.
You know, when you see how the headlines of this deal and what will be able to happen if it's accepted versus what it was post-Brexit. Like we found ourselves in this situation. The people of Northern Ireland did. They didn't want Brexit, right? So we had to deal with what we were dealt with. It seems to answer an awful lot of the concerns that were there. Maybe not specific 6 or 7 point plans, but in terms of, you know, a great deal of freedom, the majority of the time, west to east, it seems to satisfy those concerns.
Yeah, I think there were concerns rightly from the unionist perspective, and some of them felt a bit disenfranchised by this. This deal has been very, very carefully worked out. It allows free trade east-west, it allows free trade north-south and into the single market from business in the north of Ireland. They have exposure to 500 million people in Europe and 65 million people in Britain. It's absolutely a win-win for them. There's no border in the Irish Sea, there's no border on the island of Ireland. There's minimalistic checks through these green and red pathways. And actually, the market and commerce will dictate which pathway people choose. If I was running a business in the north of Ireland and I had the potential to sell to 500 million people, well, I'd be looking to make the declarations that allowed me to do so. But that's a matter for the business people and the communities in the north.
I mean, should we be thanking the DUP? Because it's possible that, you know, this was all part of the EU discouraging members from leaving, making it purposely difficult for Britain, for being, you know, awkward. In other words, an awful lot of this, you can imagine, could have been resolved in the first round of negotiations.
Well, I think the EU has shown flexibility at every single stage, and the EU have been honest brokers at every single stage. I don't know that we necessarily need to thank the DUP. Certainly, you could argue that things have improved, but maybe if the British government had gone to the negotiating table honestly and fairly from the first stage, it's quite clear that Boris Johnson wasn't as open and honest as he could have been. It's quite clear that at times Liz Truss wasn't, for example. So I think I would thank the EU and the EU negotiators for every single time being solution-based and looking for that. And at this stage, I think we need to thank all parties, the British government, the Irish government and the EU, for getting a resolution.
Well, it's not over the line yet, Tom, but, you know, you're not going to reverse Brexit at this stage, so it's time to come up with a new name, is it?
Yeah. Well, it's not over the line. I suppose to some extent that we're happy that there's no border in Ireland. I think realistically, politically, it will be over the line. I think, yes, certain parties are going to take time. I spent most of last night reading articles 62 to 67, which is all about the Stormont break. And I'm still not 100% clear
Tom,
on exactly
the I'm going to get you a Netflix subscription. This is just unacceptable.
And neither is anybody that I've spoken to, including a constitutional lawyer in a university in the north last night. So there are people who are going to take time. But I think we all know politically this solves the will of the majority of people of North of Ireland, certainly the majority of people of the Republic of Ireland, that we get on with normal, peaceful living on the island of Ireland.
And exactly, and that's it, and maintaining that. And we've had very sharp reminders as of late what it used to be like, and we really, really don't want to go back there. From a commerce perspective, it seems now, you know, we're seeing record exports out of Northern Ireland, and you know, you're speaking and have an insight, of course, into business communities in the six counties of Northern Ireland. There's an awful lot of opportunity already being exploited, but certainly even further down the line. I mean, it's a very unique position Northern Ireland finds itself in on an international sort of stage.
Yeah, I think the day that the protocol bill was signed, I was sitting in Brussels and I did an interview with you, and we called the north of Ireland the Hong Kong of Europe. Mm. And I think it's cemented in that position again now. If you look at the way economies have fallen in the last year because of the war in Ukraine and other international pressures, the north of Ireland fell significantly less than the British economy. And that is entirely because of its position within the EU and within the internal market for Britain and the single market within the EU. So the north of Ireland has already seen the advantages of this being in place, and the opportunities to expand that and to grow further are huge. And we all know that one of the foundations of a peace process is economic and social development. And nobody can question that there's been huge economic and social development in the north of the last 25 years. And it is now at a rate which will increase beyond that within Britain, possibly beyond that within the Republic of Ireland. But its ties to two different economies is a huge advantage for the north of Ireland.
Yeah, and it's proven, as what you say, there's studies on it that, you know, the more successful Northern Ireland is, the greater peace has a chance. Tom, absolutely. As always, thanks very much for your time. We do appreciate it. We don't want to lose you thanks, talking Greg. About this stuff. So if you do have to come up with a different name, we can adapt.
I'm sure okay. we will.
All right, thanks, take Greg. Care of yourself. Okay. All right, Tom, thanks. Bye-bye. Tom Murray, spokesperson for Border Communities Against Brexit. Now, of course, then we're talking about the headline stuff, aren't we? East-West borders, north-south borders, making sure not there, the freedom of people to move around. Land-based businesses doing well, of course, in terms of exports and what have you. But there were other consequences of Brexit. Our fishermen and women, very much affected by this. Liam O'Brien is a fisherman, joins us from time to time on the show. Liam, is there anything in this that addresses the situation as it relates to, the problems facing the fishing industry at the moment? Because we've been highlighting them for years here in terms of where you can land fish, where you can't land fish, and all the red tape, where you can and can't fish. Liam, do you think this addresses any of that, or maybe it's not even on the radar?
Good morning, Greg. I don't know. Maybe it's like everything else for the fishing industry at the moment, especially in the inshore fishing industry. It'll be swept onto the carpet. It'll be a speck of dust. It's just that with this going on here, like the fishermen are crippled where they can go and weather and one thing and another.
Talk to us about that. Talk about that, because we shouldn't presume we all remember or all knew in the first place. Post Brexit, how did the life for a fisher change?
Well, when it come January of the last year, any boats entering, Northern Ireland boats entering the ports in the south, they had to notify the SFPA, the fisheries in the south. They put up a time limit. It was basically, we thought there was a border. It was you couldn't land before 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You couldn't land after 8 o'clock in the evening. And then at Friday evening would be the last landing over the weekend within the south. And now, that's the Northern Ireland boats. I would fish a Southern Ireland boat and be working out of County Down and Kilkeel. And if I was fishing out in Dundalk Bay, along with the Northern Ireland boats, all joined together, fishing out there, I would have to notify the UK government that I was going into Northern Ireland to land me product. But I didn't seem to have the same time embargo as the Northern Ireland fishing boats, as me, a Southern Ireland fishing boat.
So really, if I'm reading this correctly, a lot of the problems that you and others face could be resolved administratively, if you know what I mean. We don't need to renegotiate. I mean, in other words, you could be accommodated more freely by the Irish authorities, for example, or the British authorities, or the Northern Irish authorities, whatever. Like, we don't really need a negotiated change to anything at this point. It would be welcomed, but we just need people working longer hours and to be more accommodating. That would resolve some of this, at least, Liam?
I don't think it would need to, like, because you have the lock agents, they can work north and south off the border. They share their waters within the Irish boats, share their waters within Lough Foyle. It doesn't need to be an issue. There is issues with Northern Ireland boats landing along at Quigley's Point, would have been an old traditional place of landing. They would have been close to even to Derry in that, but it was never an issue. I don't think it's a big issue to relax the laws. Basically, we're talking about non-quoted species. Mm. There was quoted species. Crab, lobster, oyster are not quota species.
Now, there's a safety element to this too, Liam, isn't there, obviously?
There is a big safety element to it, because at this time of year and way back during the winter, the weather and where the boats are fishing, a lot of these boats are out of Greencastle is fishing out in Northern Ireland waters anyway. I'd be fishing in southern waters and they're coming into Kilkeel. And I was told, I was in last summer, they told me that the Northern Ireland government had upped the ante for the pressure, and I do believe, and I say they are right, the Irish government was the ones that put this into place, and they were sort of lashing back on it. But we seem to be the subjects of the lash back on it, the fishermen. Like, we're going through a very delicate point now in our fisheries in Dundalk Bay, and the Kilkeel men's doing the same, and vice versa up here in the North Coast with us offshore one. We don't know if we're going to be there in 5 years, 3 years. We don't know where our fishing grounds are going to be.
That's it.
Because with all this offshore one.
Yeah, and a lot of that uncertainty, as you say, is not related to Brexit. We've talked about, Liam, that in the past, and we will into the future as
Greg,
well.
There is no young men coming into industry. No. What young men's there is in the boats there, and you try to encourage them in. We see our culture as like a small farmer. He needs a second job. He needs that more now than he needs the farming.
And this is not an industry that can skip a generation either.
It can't. No. Like, there's nobody going into the college in Greencastle. Most of them is going into doing other courses other than fishing. And it's a sad state of affairs where we're going here with us.
All right.
And it's the same in County, it's the same in Northern Ireland too.
All right.
It's the same, it's a mirror effect over the coast.
All right. Listen, before I let you go, something completely different. Yeah. Maybe you have an insight because you're out in the water. A few listeners getting on to us talking about lots of dead squid being washed up on beaches, Culdaff in particular. Lots of dolphins getting washed up as well. Any insight from a man on the sea into what might be causing that?
I've seen something up on Facebook. I'm originally from Kildare, like, but I don't know. It could be shoals of fish putting them ashore. I didn't see someone who was saying about it. It could be shoals of fish.
Okay.
It could be a herring along the coast that left the locks there now. That could be. I still see a lot of bird activity on photographs there of our Kildare there and that there. I don't think it's a thing, but I don't know if there's any. I've never heard of dolphins now being up, and I know they have a worldwide problem over in the thing. They're blaming lobster men over in New South Wales or something for whales going up on the shore. But it wasn't the lobster men of all their pots on and that. It wasn't it. They don't know what's going on there.
All right, okay. So you're saying it could be nature?
It's just could be nature. Like the one was out to the northeast, out north there, coming in there all week last week there. And easterly one, and just I don't know now what's happening.
All right, then.
I don't know how about here after a while.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know. I couldn't tell you about last year with a wee crab that would the crab that will be a molting that will be now the crab will come in to molt now to grow because they have to shed the shell. That would be a phenomenon last year there where we had that incident with crab that as I was a child. When I was a child, that was always a phenomenon along the tide lines in the river. You see dead crab. It's the molting, they maybe don't recover from the molt.
Right.
And what happens today? That's what happens. That's what they call in England is a peeler crab. It sheds a shell, allows for the expansion of the body to grow, and then it puts back on that shell. It'll lie in a place until it would harden the shell and come out. And it's just the elements in that there. So a lot of it, some of them die.
All right, Liam.
Basically the same thing.
Really appreciate Greg. That. And come here. I appreciate you talking to us a little bit about that stuff. It doesn't take away from the very strong points you made as it relates to the pressures on the industry. But, you know, while I had you on,
We don't want to mess the boat this time on it either because we just can't have enough pressures as it is.
No, we'll ask. Listen,
thanks
I'll ask
very much, Greg.
To see if we can get some answers. Thanks very much indeed, Liam. Take care. Danielle Lochry joins us on the programme. Member of the LGFA, of course. Good morning, Danielle. Thanks for taking the call today.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Right. Okay. So you've been expressing your concerns about the sport. Of course, the LGFA labels itself as a diverse and inclusive organisation. Where are we at in terms of a transgender policy? Is there one in place at the moment? Are we at the talking point or are we actually saying we need to have the conversation?
Where we are at the moment is that the transgender policy is in place with the LGFA. It came to a Central Council meeting on Wednesday, the 15th of February, where the people present there were asked to vote on it so that it could be adopted. Now, it was voted in that night, but the 80 people present there hadn't been given any time to consult or hold talks with their clubs, their county boards, their players, their coaches. So this is just something that the LGFA said they went into extensive consultations with, but yet we have no idea who they consulted with because they definitely didn't speak to anybody at grassroots level about the implementation of this policy.
Right, so as it stands, what level of inclusion is there of transgender women? At what grade of the sport or what are the qualifying criteria or what's the story now as we speak?
Well, it's from over 12 upwards. So now anybody under 18, of course, has to get parental consent and different things like that there. But the general basis of it is if they get a letter from their GP stating that they are transitioning or have fully transitioned from male to female, and, you know, the GP signs that. Also, they have to show that their testosterone levels in the last 12 months have been under 10 nanomoles per litre. And from what I can tell, that's the only real stipulations. If they can prove that, then they may get approved to play. There is a section on it then where it talks about if the committee deems that there is an unacceptable risk, then that they can refuse the application. But yet there's no specification as to what they deem an unacceptable risk or anything like that.
But Danielle, do we know at this point if anyone has gone through that process? Because I don't think we're ever going to be talking about, you know, three or four players in every team in the country. I mean, we're talking about a very small number of people, I would presume.
Yes.
Like, is the level of concern and calls for this to be rescinded justified, considering, as I say, it's not a problem at the moment, is it?
Well, there may not be, like I said, it's a brand new application for them, so there's nobody who has been approved at the moment. But there have been incidents, in particular, I think last year, a lot of people may have heard about the transgender woman who played in a junior final in Dublin. And if you've seen the pictures from that, you'll see why it is an issue. Mm. But that is only one gentleman that is, or transgender woman, sorry, that has been publicly shown. I'm sure there are more that may want to play our sport, but I just feel the LGFA are bowing to the minority rather than speaking to their members.
And the concerns are you've outlined your concerns as to why you believe that this policy is a danger to women playing the sport. So run through that for us, would you?
Yeah, well, if a boy goes through male puberty, let's say he's going to automatically become stronger, faster. He'll have better muscle mass, less body fat. He's a better capacity for aerobic activity. You know, they are generally fitter than us and can recover better than us. So when you put that then on a pitch against a girl who is already fighting, you know, for a spot there against her own female participants, that I just think it brings on a bigger danger, an injury. It's an injury concern. You look at there was a match on Sunday against Tyrone and Westmeath. There was a clash between two female players. That girl, it took 20 minutes before she was put on an ambulance to take off the pitch. Now, if you put that female up against a biological male on that pitch, what could you be looking at there?
Yeah. And I see the image that you're talking of there, and we don't want to offend anyone or upset anyone, but I think if people see images from that game that you talk of, there's a clear physical difference in size there, and a collision like the one you've described would have a very different outcome. And it's a difficult one, Danielle, isn't it, to have this conversation? But you have to, I suppose, stand up for the women playing the sport and their rights. So there are competing rights here.
There are, yes. You know, we talk a lot about retention of players. And, you know, if this does come to fruition and there is more and more transgender women in our team, well, girls are going to be losing out spots possibly to these players. They're going to feel uncomfortable if we have to use shared changing rooms and shared facilities.
Well, I think also too, what will happen is maybe some parents would not allow their girls to field for fear of injury or something. And we've seen it here, when there is a collision or something. So I think, okay. And what is the decision-making process from here, Danielle? Because I think maybe there is a sense that, I wonder, was this a rushed decision? We've seen other sports now sort of going back the way a little bit. Have you got a sense of what might come from the LGFA's representations on this, from the likes of yourself?
No, we haven't received much communication. Now, it seems that just the policy is in place. Sorry, excuse me. But I just want every player, every club, every county board to make their concerns known to the LGFA and you know, speak to them. Congress is coming up now on Friday. Have it brought up there that we need to have further discussions on this, that it's not something that can be just put into place and everybody needs to just get on and accept it.
Okay.
We need proper guidance on how it took place and what we're supposed to do coming forward from here. But, yeah, things need to be a lot more open and a lot more communication, and hopefully we'll get some sort of resolution to it within the next while.
Right, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. That's Daniel Lochry there. Do you agree that the LGFA's transgender policy should be rescinded? Get involved in the conversation.